What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, listeners, and thank you for tuning in to the Eyewitness History Podcast. This episode, I speak with Steve O'Donnell. Steve O'Donnell is a television writer. His credits include Late Night with David Letterman, The Simpsons, Seinfeld, and The Chris Rock Show. He was also the head writer for Jimmy Kimmel Live from the show's debut in January 2003 until 2008. Additionally, he worked with the great Norm Macdonald as a writer for Norm Macdonald Has a Show and Norm Macdonald Live. And now I give you Steve O'Donnell.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Okay, I'm here with Steve O'Donnell. Steve, thanks for coming on the podcast, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to it. I'll try to offer a historical perspective, which at this point in my life is pretty much the one perspective I've got.
Well, I appreciate that. Well, I'm really excited to speak with you. I've been looking forward to this since you and I first started talking. Before we get into everything, Steve, please tell our listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
Well, I am a behind-the-scenes writer and laborer in TV comedy. I've done print work. I have written articles and drawn cartoons and things like that. But primarily, it's been television and substantially late-night television. So I worked for Letterman for a decade. I worked for Jimmy Kimmel for a decade. A few years here and there with Chris Rock, Hannibal Buress, Bonnie Hunt, the Al Franken. And then the last decade, happily and sadly, with Norm Macdonald, who is one of the most extraordinary people ever. And as we're speaking, as the year 2023 wraps up, and I can't help but reflect on the good fortune that I've had. And one of the luckiest things was getting to know him, because he was just a very rich, warm, mysterious, oddball, genius, entertaining goof of a character. And someone that I guess you can happily say his memory always brings a smile or a laugh of some kind. And also, we did a lot of podcasts together. And here now, you and I are doing a podcast.
How about that? No, I appreciate that, Steve. Thank you. Yes, the great Norm Macdonald. I certainly have time set aside later on to discuss him. I would never squander that opportunity. I'd love to wind the clock back, Steve, and ask you, what was it that drew you to comedy? A question I'm sure you've never been asked before.
I love you using a nice analog image, like a clock that has to be wound.
I'm old fashioned.
Some of it is just, I don't know how much is accidental, because you grow up in a baby boom era and there's loads of cartoons on television and so on. It may have been that my twin brother and I, Larkoda, who have had kind of intertwining, parallel, and diverging careers in writing and comedy, we're the 9th and 10th of 10 brothers and sisters. And I think that allowed us to be a little sillier. You know, my dad would try to teach me about the carburetor and the transmission and the electrical system, and we'd be under the car and he'd go, so if it's not the battery, it's the solenoids. And I'm just laying there going, how soon can I go inside and watch F Troop and reread the Mad magazine I've already read 15 times? So because my older brothers had actual skills, which they still have, they could fix things and build things. Mark and I could be a little sillier. We were a little indulged. We were the babies. An odd thing about our sisters and brothers that of the 10, there were 5 brothers, 5 sisters, 5 blue-eyed, 5 brown-eyed, 5 left-handed, and 5 right-handed, including my twin brother and I. He was left-handed and I was right-handed, kind of mirror image identicalness, I guess. There was also just something about one's disposition. I know that I had some discrimination about things that were funny, even as a kid. I had playmates who liked Hanna-Barbera cartoons, and they couldn't distinguish them from Warner Brothers cartoons. And I was like, I pitied them. You know, you'll watch a Wally Gator or a Peter Potamus and think that is as satisfactory as, you know, Wile E. Coyote or Bugs Bunny or Daffy Duck or one of those masterpieces. So who knows? I would also say my family was quite funny, but also so decent as to never consider like, oh, we'll do this for a living.
Right.
And my dad, extremely wry and sarcastic, you know, like we'd be walking down the street and there'd be some hoodlum kids hanging around the corner. He'd go, oh, there's some leading citizens. There's some pillars of the community. Some small amount of money, he would just say, ah, down payment on a ham sandwich. He was full of this Bowery Boys type slang. You know, I mean, he grew up in the 1930s himself, so it was kind of like a wonderful time machine. All my uncles, too. As long as we're talking history, 3 of my uncles, not great uncles, my dad's older brothers, were doughboys in France, fought in the Meuse Argonne in World War I.
Wow.
And of course, ongoing, yes. My dad's parents and my mom's parents came from Europe. I think about that, too. Like, what a weird bit of history. When they arrived on the eve of the great First World War, my dad's parents came from a country that were subjects of a king. And my mom's parents were an old fealty to an emperor of Austria-Hungary because they were Slovenian. And they arrived, you know, early 20th century in the country. But anyway, so I had that perspective, too. And also, I grew up in Cleveland, which in a way is kind of a New Jersey, Brooklyn kind of place where it's unglamorous in a way that fosters funny mechanisms, you know, to deal with life. So there was that. Also, just the fact of this house, you know, a dozen plus people in one house talking, and they were pretty good-natured and pretty forbearing. I mean, there was minimal fighting and Dutch rubs. But they were verbal. They were funny. But Mark and I were the only ones with the gumption to consider putting it down and try doodling and drawing funny cartoonish pictures and so on. So there's that. I would also say we had the great good luck. But this is like 6 lumps of good luck in the space of a few years. We got scholarships, full scholarships to Harvard.
Yes.
Paid for the whole thing. So on the one hand, people can hate me because I would. He's got Ivy League grad. But on the other hand, my dad, a welder, by the way, worked at the same job for 50 years. I've got his lunchbox in my kitchen here.
Oh.
He called it his lunch pail. This was also something historical. Just my parents were full of like, go scrub your teeth. It's brush your teeth, Mom. The lunch pail is a lunchbox. Anyway, but at Harvard, they have a little club, an organization, a student activity, a magazine called The Lampoon. And that was something that not every college has, but I think more and more colleges do now. A place where you could experiment and stretch your, now I don't know which metaphor to use. I'll just say muscles, your comedy muscles, your writing muscles, your cartooning muscles. And you're also around people. Probably the most important thing, you've probably heard this from some of the other writers in entertainment and popular arts type people you talk to. You got to find people that do what you do.
Yeah.
You got to be around them. It's not just to have a network. It's to have a spiritual kin group. Yeah. It's like you want to latch on to the people who are below you on the ladder and like what you like, as well as the people that are above you on the ladder. You just want to be around people that get things partly in the same way you do, ideally.
Like letting you know you're not alone. You're not the only one that thinks this way.
Yes. And more productive and positive even than that, as comforting as that might be, is they offer a kind of role model, a kind of bar you want to live up to. when I think of my early years at Letterman, the original head writer, Meryl Marco, this fantastic woman who remains amazingly funny and productive. She has a Substack. I'm throwing that word around now. Now that I know what it is. And is really funny. And just someone that you really would think, would Meryl be embarrassed about this if she were to know I wrote it? So you would always try to make it as good as you could, or make it depart from the expected. Jim Downey was another.
Later Jim Downey.
Oh, I forgot. The encomium, as in Homer, the great Jim Downey. I quite agree. I don't think I can't imagine him taking recourse to a cliche. And I've worked with plenty of writers who, here and there, they had to go with something that was familiar and they knew something like it had gotten laughs before. Now, that would not be Downey. That would not be Meryl Marco. And there were many, many other people in different ways along the way. Chris Rock, just that was like, it'd be over pretentious to say it was transforming, but I just felt I had the luckiest. All these different groups of writing compatriots, and it was so interesting. I would say also here, just in a very general historical way, here's some general things I've seen happen in a half century of writing comedy. It's gone from rooms full of sort of nerdish, bespectacled, goofball Irish and Jewish guys, white guys who were not athletes, that ate like children, to rooms that are diverse, that have women in them, that are attractive even. You know, sometime around John Mulaney and Tina Fey, funny people could also start being attractive. And there's way more of them. You look at comedy writing rooms now, there's men and women, South Asians, African Americans. It's way better. But at the same time, those old nerds, there was something funny about them. They were all like, they all looked like Arnold Stang or, you just self-repaired eyeglasses and, picking the mushrooms off their pizza. And so I just go, what a bunch of, not me, of course. No,
of course not.
I was like, it's not. But over the decades, little by little, I've seen the inroads come. More and more females in the late night writers' rooms. More and more attractive people. More and more attractive hosts. Mm-hmm. More and more funny, attractive hosts. They've always been attractive hosts, but most of them were blank as could be. But again, the last few decades have seen that change. The other thing, too, I had the valuable and precious experience to be a white writer on a couple of black shows. And I think that experience is growing rarer, and for a good reason. You don't want to have half and half out of, a black entertainer ought to be able to have black writers.
Yeah.
Chris Rock, though, was so kind of universal in his way. He definitely did black-centered stuff. The first week I was on the show, he said, don't worry about trying to write things black. Just write them the way you think is funny. And when I do them, they'll be black because I'm black.
Yeah, the filter.
And I early on made the correct decision. It wasn't not even a decision. It was a natural intuition to not try the slightest thing. I've seen white writers try to master complicated handshakes and absurd street slang and stuff. I remained the horrible, bookish goofball that you see before you now. I would see like Ali Leroy, one of the black writers, coming down the hall at Chris Rock and go, Ali, give me five. In an orderly fashion, and I would stick up my hand the way a businessman would, and we would shake hands like we had just closed a mortgage. It was such a gift to me because I like my office was right next to Wanda Sykes. I'm trying to like make this sound historical.
Yeah.
She was just coming up at the time, and I would just hear the craziest things through the wall that I would just lay back with my eyes closed and go, well, this is such a treat. I just suddenly hear, who the f*** sat on my church hat? And I go, I hope that's a bit. But even if it isn't, it's wonderful. And I made friends there as I made at Letterman that have lasted for a lifetime. And I've been very fortunate for that. Also, you discover interesting things like Chris Rock was really into and might still be into Led Zeppelin. If you were writing a corny screenplay, we would be all into soul music or hip hop or something. And he and I shared an enthusiasm for two different Christmas specials, the Mr. Magoo Christmas special. He knew all the lyrics to all the songs. And obviously Charlie Brown Christmas, because he was made of stone, not to like not to like that program. But that was a great gift to me from the universe. And as these decades went by and as these centuries unspooled, there were more and more late night shows. I had the experience working on Letterman, where it was really one of only two, maybe three late night shows. There was Carson, there was Letterman, then there were not really any serious contenders. There was Marginalia until Arsenio arrived. He was a substantial event on the historical timeline. I mean, it was a very exciting show, though having, I'll use an undeserved military metaphor, having fought in those trenches, I could see they could not hold it up. Him coming out and waving his fist and having the crowd whoop, and how you can't do that for years and years and years.
It doesn't scale.
As if it were just the most fantastic celebratory party every single night. Or maybe I'm just a dullard and could not appreciate. But anyway, Arsenio did a fun, completely different kind of show. And that was an interesting thing to see happen. And then it just started proliferating like mad. And then from Jon Stewart, who also took my twin brother's class, then the late night landscape started mushrooming, proliferating, and also weirdly homogenizing. They all became kind of political platforms. Norm used to complain that they were all sort of preachy and scolding, whereas he really longed for something just completely silly. And I told him, no, Norm, get in line. No, kind of agreed with him. He had, well, I'm getting off the track here. You want to do things in an orderly. Get to Norm MacDonald. I only say that he had certain wonderful old-fashioned tastes. He loved Bob Hope, for example. We used to talk Bob Hope all the time. And not just because we were old guys. We were kids when Bob Hope was getting old. But it was just something where he appreciated the style. The way even like a Woody Allen could appreciate the style of a Bob Hope. If you're into, you know, Bearing and Living and so on. But so I did see things change as time went along. Not only are there now like 30 late night shows, I think we're starting to see that erode. The fact that Stephen Colbert chose not to perpetuate the late show as a talk show, as a late night comedy variety show, but to try After Midnight, which I guess it's going to be a panel with comics, you know, so that not quite a game show format, but at least everyone seems to be acknowledging, okay, maybe we've had enough of these. The desk, the couch, the chairs, the plug. Also, for interview purposes, podcasts really cover that stuff now. To watch Conan, to watch any of the dozens of, including your own, although you don't focus merely on comedy.
Not merely.
But the interviews are so much more satisfying and detailed. All you're really missing is, you know, Karnak predicting the question while he's reading the answer, you know, the desk pieces.
Or Andy Richter leaning in with the comment, right?
But by the way, a strange, strong point I could make to my students at NYU. The last year I've taught a class at NYU. We had our last one last night. But I would show them from the late 1990s that wonderful Conan piece in the year 2000.
Yeah.
With the cheesy, scary flashlight lighting. And I'd say, what do you think they did when the year 2000 arrived, when it came and went? And they're like, make it in the year 3000, you know, make it. And I went, no. They just kept saying in the year 2000 as if they were predicting the future. And why not? Who's to stop them? Where's the? And I kept saying, it's not just that one funny joke decision. It's a whole mindset, which is, who says? I'll just do whatever I want. The Republic will not collapse. And yes, early Conan. Oh, current Conan. Talk about the podcasts and the variety of shows. I just think,
oh, he's incredible. I've been a fan of his for a long time. And I was cruising YouTube, and what do I see but a very old Dick Cavett appearance between with you and him.
Yeah, that went largely unnoticed for 25 years or so. And then somewhere somebody unearthed it and started showing. At the time we were doing it, I thought it was a little peculiar because at that time we sort of resembled each other. By the way, if I may quote and name drop at the same time, just to show how funny Conan can be spontaneously, I saw him at a gathering, you know, a fancy showbiz party in Hollywood. No, it was some sort of picnic. And I said, oh, they're showing that Dick Cavett clip that you and I rode the car service out to Fort Lee, New Jersey, you know, because it was at like CNBC or something like that to do. And he remembered me. I said, we looked very similar in those days because we both had the Kennedy-esque mop of hair, which I don't have anymore. But he looked at me, oh, well, see, it'd be better if I was wearing my glasses now. But I have these tortoiseshell glasses that I wear. And he just said, well, you have the Joe Kennedy eyeglasses. And I went, Joe Kennedy, a Joe Kennedy joke. Very funny. So he not only remembered the incident, but was able to produce an unorthodox Kennedy joke.
Anyway, Lee Konin, history and comedy intersecting.
And also, just literally, he's a history buff.
Very much so.
He'll have somebody on who just wrote a biography of Woodrow Wilson, something like that. You go like, well, wow. Yeah. I don't see Carson doing that in his heyday.
No. And I know Konin sits on the Kennedy board. I know he's a big fan of Robert Caro's biography on Lyndon Baines Johnson. Can you tell him a nerd?
I don't know what the Kennedy board is. You mean for the School of Government, for the library?
I think it's for the Kennedy Center, if I'm not mistaken. He was interviewed on it some while back, and the moderator that introduced him said he's a sitting board member of such and such. Couldn't be further from the point, but
no,
interesting.
It's directly to the point, and I've learned something.
Steve, what do you think makes good comedy writing versus bad comedy writing? I suspect there's no one-size-fits-all answer, but I just wonder what stirs in your mind as I ask that.
Well, a distinctive voice, something that you think I wouldn't have heard this somewhere else. And hearing it or just seeing it in print unattributed, you go, I'll bet that's Mitch Hedberg, or I'll bet that's Stephen Wright. Or would that possibly be a Tina Fey, Amy Poehler kind of clip? I mean, to have a distinctive original quality, of course. I don't know about rules. It's a good place to start to say short and punchy, but even that doesn't always apply. Let us refer once again to Norm MacDonald in The Moth.
Was ever
a greater example of padding and time killing that was, you know, ecstatic and beautiful and weirdly fascinating and ultimately hilarious when you get to the punchline. So I suppose it's like music and jazz and things. You go like, well, there's rules, but you can break them if you're good.
If you're good.
I think there should be a joy in it, you know, not just to like, oh, this is where political humor often disappoints. It goes to the same punchline, the same familiar target, and the same way of putting it down over and over and over and over again. Whereas, I don't know, a lot of it's taste. I mean, I observed on the street I grew up out in Cleveland, and it has remained true into all my intercontinental travels, that more than food, more than music, I think sense of humor and what makes you laugh is so subjective. I have people that just, they don't get Jack Handy. They'll read Deep Thoughts and they'll go, that just seems dumb. That seems like he doesn't know what he's talking about. I go, isn't that funny to you? But on the other hand, again, I talked about how my dad had this wry, sarcastic sense of humor. My mom was so much sweeter and in this way, simpler. If you folded up a newspaper and made a sort of Napoleon hat and put it on it, marched around the room, that would make her laugh. You know, you'd be like, well, see, that wouldn't do it for my dad, but it did it for my mom. And you just go like, isn't that mysterious? It's where you come from and what sort of relief you're looking for and what sort of function you want humor to fulfill. If the perpetrator of the jokes takes a kind of joy in it themselves. When I was a kid,
right,
I thought stand-up comedy was terrible. I just went, everybody in my family, everybody on the street, grew up on this funnier than these people. It'd be these old guys that would come out and talk about their mothers-in-law and double parked cars. And I'm just going, their heart isn't even in it. They're going to these sort of rote punchlines, you know. You'll still see it occasionally. Hey, everybody hates fruitcake, am I right? You know, to use a seasonal go-to, where there's no joy in the creation of it or the delivery of it. And can hardly be joy in the reception of it. So if the creator takes some joy in it, you at least have a chance to get a little bit of that joy on your end, the receiving, when you're the podcastee and not the podcaster.
Well, no, I appreciate that. I think that the joy aspect is really important. Now, I'll give you a very quick anecdote. Probably the cleverest thing I've ever said was to my mom a few years ago. I think you'll like this. I hope it makes you laugh. We were having dinner and I'm taking care of my dishes after I'm done. I put them in the sink sinfully. I meant to put them in the dishwasher, which is open. My mom says to me, with my brother in the room, my mom says, Josh, how do you explain no dishes in the sink? And how do you explain a dish in the sink and no dishes in the dishwasher? And without missing a beat, I take a pause and I go, oh, poor parenting. My mom and my brother just died laughing. It was one of the highlights of my year.
Excellent. Deflect it. You'd be a good politician. Your mom laugh over that?
Oh, she laughed very hard. My mom is, we come from a sarcastic family, not unsimilar to yours, where you know, it's all about who can do it quicker, you know?
Oh, well, yes, that's another fun atmosphere to grow up in. Well, maybe it's not always fun. I've read enough memoirs of, you know, growing up on the Lower East Side where there's a lot of squabbling over the dinner table and so on. But it leads to a kind of contentious verbal agility.
Yes.
It's not a single fountain. It's not a single source that I think humor and jokes spring from. A lot of people insist it's all anger. It's all rage. And I go, there's a good amount of that. But there are people, again, you mentioned the great Jim Downey. I think he takes a happiness in it. It's like the pleasure of someone building something, someone playfully assembling something out of thin air, just using existing words and concepts and images, and suddenly you've made something that wasn't ever existing before. Again, you know, there's a kind of satisfaction in it for them. It's not just zing, I gotcha, I killed, boom.
Right.
Though that can be pretty great too. I mean, that can be pretty great too. Again, through Norm Macdonald and through Kimmel and others, I mean, I got to be close at hand when people like Don Rickles. And even Jack Carter. Jack Carter was like the last old Borscht Belt comic that came through on Norm's old podcast that we used to do. And they did believe in the zinger, the put down, you know, the burn.
Right.
And there was a kind of art to that. But that's like, you know, Yo-Yo Ma can take his hat off to B.B. King. You know, there's more than one way to skin the artistic cat.
Indeed. I'd love to ask you about The Simpsons, Steve.
Oh. So,
yeah, I know you wrote, among others, you wrote Season 9, Episode 13, The Joy of Sect, which was about the Marian cult. Yeah. I'd love to ask you, how did you become a writer for The Simpsons, and what was the process of writing that episode like?
Oh, well, this I'm going to be a shabby and shameful example all the way around on this. I only wrote two episodes, and one of them was a clip anthology, a clip show that, frankly, The Simpsons writers and other sitcom writers would refer to shamefully. You know, we'll do the Christmas flashback show. We'll do anyway, it was a musical flashback. The only thing I'll say about before I get back to the cult show, the musical clip show, at least in its way, was based on something that had actually happened to me when I was like 22. I went to a Blockbuster in my hometown of Cleveland, Ohio, which I may have mentioned. I wanted to get a Clint Eastwood movie, and they only had one Clint Eastwood movie left. And it was Paint Your Wagon, which I knew nothing about. And I brought it to my friend Bob's house, and we start watching it. I go, it's a musical. He's singing. And it was just like the biggest baffling disappointment you could conceive of. So I used that as a sort of springboard. The cult one, I have to say, I had good luck. And this is something that maybe is some old boy network or something. But I had been, I think, demonstrated some ability to at least deliver conscientiously. They invited me to write an episode. And I went in, we talked about various premises and things like that. And the problem was there's a superior episode about a secret society.
Yes.
The Stonecutters, which really is better. But there's some overlap. I will say, wait, we can talk about history again. Because I did a full draft about the cult I came up with, which I called the Movementarians, which they liked. But between the time I sent it to them and the time they got back to me, the Heaven's Gate cult had their mass suicide. And so many of the tales that I included in my cult script seemed exactly like that. They wore purple robes. They were waiting for a UFO. And it was like, I had no idea that there was going to be in the future this cult suicide. But it made me sad six ways. For one thing, these people killed themselves in a cliched way. Like, I could anticipate what an insane cult would do. Wait for a UFO to come. Oh, partly because there's half a dozen cults that are, and a couple of fairly mainstream religions that have as a tenet the idea that some external extraterrestrial force will arrive in a sort of millennial way and take all the true believers away while destroying everyone else. So I had to rewrite the whole, thing. And I should point out that compared to the people that really write Simpsons episode, I am a mere asterisk and footnote on the map. But boy, was it, again, there too, to be around that group. Most Simpsons scripts are an amalgamation with a lot of table input. Mine had a minimal amount. I say that with some pride because it was not hugely unchanged from the, I think they were also trying to fill in two or three holes they had at the end of a season. Like, let's plug these in. Mm-hmm. And if we can get a semi-reliable writer who's worked for Al Franken and Chris Rock and Dave Letterman, maybe that'll do. I wrote two episodes of Space Ghost, which,
yes,
I take a little, I could be more proud of because I think I did a more distinctive job. I'm proud of my Simpsons episode, but I just, it's ridiculous to, for me to, it's the way I worked on Seinfeld for 2 years and I had two episodes and plenty of plot lines in other episodes, but I can't claim to be a pillar of that organization. I'm much more of a shingle, but
that's good.
Still, for me, a fantastic experience. And I did do my level best to like try to give them what they wanted and something they didn't have already. That's kind of the trick all the way through. I've used the phrase familiar and freak. You want to give them what is the character and nature of their show already, and then give them some wild card element as well. So they go, oh, he can fit in, but he can also add or depart in some left field or right field way.
Well, I do think, if you'll permit me to say, I think you're being a little modest about your time with Seinfeld. I mean, just for our listeners, one of the episodes you wrote was called The Pothole. And if I don't miss my mark, I think Seinfeld was on, was it The Tonight Show, the night before the episode aired and said it was one of the best of the series.
Yes, he's a good promoter. He actually used to call it the O Seinfeld because I co-wrote it with a writer named O'Keefe.
Right.
So it's O'Donnell and O'Keefe. But the pothole part of it, you've heard this ad nauseum. Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld like plot lines that had actually happened to the writers or to them or to someone they knew. The pothole had happened to me. I'd been running on the streets of New York, got to my apartment and realized, because I was in a hurry, that I didn't have my keys and they must have come out of my big floppy coat pocket. I retraced my steps and I found my keys at a curb in a pothole. They'd been flown out as I leaped the pothole. But it occurred to me at that time, what if the pothole had been filled in before I had realized what happened to them? Anyway, I wrote an episode that involved a Chinese restaurant that would deliver to one side of 86th Street, but not the other. That restaurant was real and it used to frustrate me. The Hunan balcony on the Upper West Side of New York. And I said, well, this is great. It's with most premises and ideas and jokes and punchlines. They're kind of in your head already. You've already been thinking about it for a while. It's funny sometimes when I see some writers and certainly a lot of beginners and stuff who are like, they're scratching their head and pulling their chin, going, gotta think of an idea. And I go like, I don't see how an idea is going to come to you that way. Mm-hmm. It's like, what do you already kind of think about this subject? What is already in there? What are your sort of weird biases and mystifications about it that are there already? So that was helpful with the Seinfeld. The trying to think what else I used. I did have one storyline in which the Kramer is keeping Japanese businessmen in a sort of drawers under his bed. But that I had just read about, but it seemed like, well, sort of real enough. And also the checks. I thought about it a couple of days ago. In this episode I wrote called The Checks, Jerry starts making all this money, or so it seems, because a clip that shows him is in the opening montage of a show in Japan. So he gets a royalty every time the show airs. But the royalties are all like 11 cents or 70 cents or 24 cents. And I got such a package of checks the size of a phone book when the Letterman show was sold to the E! Network to run in syndication. And I thought, I'm going to be rich. But they were all super tiny checks. and I didn't want to deposit them. So I would cash them 10, 12 at a time. And you could tell the bank tellers did not look forward to seeing me coming and so on. Now, for that episode that I wrote, I get residual checks that are like for 41 cents and 15 cents. And so I go, what is this? Art imitating life, imitating art, imitating life. I don't know. That was also like, again, the people that, while we're talking about history, super history buff, Larry David.
Yes.
Super history buff. The first day I worked on the show, he came into my office, saw I was reading the David McCullough Truman biography. Not on the job, it just was on the shelf. And he started praising Truman in a way that I knew he was secretly praising himself, because he said, oh yeah, Truman, he just said it like it was. He didn't care whose feelings he hurt. He just said it, and that's why they didn't like him in Washington. And there was a pause, and I said, yeah, not like that nice Cordell Hull, who was a very obscure, like, Secretary of State or something from that era.
Right.
But it delighted Larry. He just started shouting, O'Donnell made a Cordell Hull joke, and called me Cordell Hull for several days.
That's
but
hilarious.
We bonded over being history buffs, and we would talk about new nonfiction as it would come out and so on. So a much more thoughtful, decent, kindly fellow than his caricatures would allow, as I'm sure Hugh Fink would allow.
Yes. Oh, and I've also heard, this was actually Bill Hader on Conan's podcast, actually, talking about that, you know, one thing that would surprise people about Larry David is he is a laugher. When he gets into a laughing fit, it's really tough to pull him out of it. Completely antithetical to his Curb Your Enthusiasm, you know, parody.
Yes. Yes. Or I would say Bob Einstein, you know, who played the...
Sure, Super Dave.
Yes, but also the kind of cranky friend on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, Martin.
He kind of was that character. He wasn't really a jolly jokester of a guy. The joy and delight he took in jokes tended to be his own jokes, which was kind of like a wonderful thing in itself. Kimmel always would be almost transported with delight after there was a Super Dave episode on the show and he had left. He would repeat all the compliments that Einstein had paid to himself afterwards. I say this because he was a character, and that was partly what made him distinct and colorful.
Right, exactly. Wonderful. Yes, I can't not ask you about David Letterman. We'll have to intrude the name Meryl Marco again, how she influenced your career, and perhaps I'll get there here. So obviously you were a writer for David Letterman beginning, I think, in 1982, if I don't miss
yes,
my mark.
The first year of the show. Not the first week of the show, but I came in after the first cycle. Well, two gigantic areas is Meryl Marco bestrides my world like a colossus. She hired me. She gave me my first job. That's nuts and bolts. But the other thing is she provided an unusually lofty, ideal role model who I continue to follow. She found him. She was not someone who was into TV. She thought TV was mostly sort of junky and moronic, and accurately so. She had taught art at Berkeley, so she was into the weird visuals. So she liked slightly surreal writing combined with utterly unprecedented and weird visuals. And I thought that was a wonderful way to go. And she has continued to do that kind of thing. Also, she was kindly. She was someone who was witty. Even in the tensest, most miserable times, and we had some tense and miserable times amidst the happiness and the joy that I alluded to.
Mm-hmm.
Just an original thinker, and so different from somebody who's just knows about the A story and the B story and the callback and the capper and the et cetera. A good match with Letterman, because Letterman was not without some of those qualities himself, but he was a little more, very askew and very skeptical. But still, there was the heart of a broadcaster and a host there. So Meryl could pull things a little more in a weird direction that Letterman enjoyed and could even contribute to. But I don't think it would have been as distinctive without Meryl. I'm just saying Meryl was a strong, not flavor, isn't even the right word. Her personality and Letterman's personality in equal and different portions created the atmosphere of that show. And I hope sometimes people go, oh, you know what I loved about Letterman? Oh, stupid tricks. I think they have trouble summoning specifically what they liked. I think what they liked was a whole atmosphere, an atmosphere that was slightly mocking and peculiar and rinky-dink and odd, like a silly take on it. I was watching a lot of early SCTVs in the past.
Oh, yeah.
That were from the early 80s. God, they are perfect. And they take the rinky dink and the failed and make it sublime. I could watch those forever. I could watch them lined up and the way other people could eat pizza. They're just the best. There's occasionally a show comes on that you get excited about in that way. I felt that way about South Park when it came out. What more recently? Well, so many great things. That when I was a kid, you know, it was the way that like, oh, that's good and that's sort of good and that's all right. And then Saturday Night Live came on, or National Lampoon came out, the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, holy moly, they know what they're doing. This isn't just take that NRA, take that KKK. It was like way more rich and interesting. Yeah, but I have to say that Second City, and then Letterman, when I first saw him, and I'm sure I saw him on game shows and stuff, and then his morning show first. I liked that he was uncomfortable, that he was a little leery about the whole thing. So I think some of that continues to emanate from him. He's a little mellower. In many ways, that's great. That's good. But I really liked his character. It wasn't cynical. It was smart and like, are we really going to buy this? He knew that TV, there was a certain amount of smiling, hypocritical bullshit.
Right.
He just play along, just play along. He wasn't throwing it away. He was working with it, but he said, yeah, we know what we're doing. So there was a sort of a wink and a play along kind of feeling.
The anti-talk show.
Yes. Yes. It was a show that it wasn't just like, oh, it's a gig, you know, I'll get paid every week kind of like. It was like, I felt like this was what I wanted to do. I didn't want to go like, oh, I'll go after a couple of years of this, I'll go work on a sitcom. I just didn't think those were necessarily superior pursuits. Eventually, I did do those things, but after like 13 years, almost all my decisions have been terrible. But just because that's the show I wanted to do. And again, a very corny kind of starry-eyed thing. But when they offered me the job, I mean, I would have paid them to do the show I so wanted to do, not a show like it, exactly that show. And I knew I'm not wildly self-confident and self-assured as a rule, but that I knew. I said, if they don't see that I can give them exactly what they want, they're crazy. But I guess they saw enough. I did do a submission that included a lot of drawings, which I guess Merrill, who had an artistic background, understood. Oh, he's thinking visually. You know, what are we seeing on the screen while we're hearing the words? And I guess they'd talked with, you know, some real professionals, you know, who'd worked on Mork and Mindy, who'd worked on Laverne and Shirley, and worked on the Hollywood Palace and stuff. But they left them cold. So they, to their credit, and I continue to value this principle, they looked for the unfound amateur enthusiast who was bright and original, and they gave me a break. I published dozens of magazine articles and stuff, but they were interested only in the writing that I had made in the submission that was custom made to Letterman and to Merrill's style. I asked her a few months into the working job, did you ever read any of those articles that I sent with my submission? And she said, nope, no interest. If it didn't pertain, and I exactly understand. I've worked on shows where I'm hiring people and they're sending in their novels and their play and stuff. You go, well, it's not just the time factor. It's like, I'm not even sure this tells me you can do what we need to have done. But they took a chance with me, and I will always be grateful for that. How could I not be? I just, again, the lucky break of the big family, the big verbal family, the lucky break of the college scholarship, the lucky break of Merrill and Dave Letterman taking a chance. And the other writers they took a chance on, I think one or two of them, maybe Tom Gamble and Max Frost, had worked briefly at Saturday Night Live. But almost none of us had agents. We were all in our 20s. This 40 years ago, I'm talking. And no primetime experience. I had zero. I'd written some TV commercial. I don't know how helpful those have been. And even those were gigs. Those were like my heart was in it. 70%, just enough to kind of get across what they wanted. But it wasn't like, oh, this is just the way I want to do it. But with Letterman, I just felt this is in its way beautiful, or so it seemed to me at the time. And still have the occasional bit of business and work on the Letterman YouTube channel. He'll record brand new things and post them. I've recorded a few things for it and suggested other things.
And it's kind of amazing to be back in touch with a lot of these people who I haven't seen for decades, because many of them were as close friends can be for a certain duration, you know? Your old Army buddies, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's wonderful, Steve. Thank you. Well, I'd love to ask you, I know for your work, you won an Emmy, and I'd love to know what that experience is like, and perhaps talking to any aspiring writers that might hear this, what that does for your career. I'm terribly curious what the true utility of it is.
Well, I can only speak for myself, and I'm not going to be dismissive or snooty about it, but my self-confidence was much improved and bolstered by making Letterman laugh and by making Meryl Markle laugh. By the time we were being nominated for Emmys and winning Emmys, that was just a weird, like, I can't believe this is happening. That would be like, I'm in a rental car and I'm driving up and down the Sunset Strip. You know, you'd be like, this isn't my life dream. This doesn't make me feel like a king, but interesting to see happen. I do. My brother, Mark, my twin, always kept things in perspective for me because I was nominated 20 times for an Emmy Award, but I won only 4. And Mark would say, you're a 16-time loser. And I go, fair enough.
That's either way. Other thing to say.
It's not, it doesn't really characterize him. He was so unbrother a brother. He was like some sprite or spirit from outer space when we were friends. But I do have 4, whatever they're called, statuettes, whatever. They're all in the closet. First day of class this year at NYU, I had my students, the first hour of class, deliver a 12-joke monologue about themselves. So we got to know each other, where they were from, what they were like. And when we came to the break, halfway through the evening, I gave them Emmy Awards. I said, good job. Here, you won an Emmy. I just wanted them to post the picture online saying, talk about results. My NYU class, the first one isn't even half over. I've already won an Emmy Award.
It's really kicking off.
Their monologues were actually excellent. Most people, when they talk about something they care about, and in this case, they were fairly wild families of different ethnicities, everything from India to Gambia, and I couldn't help but just be very entertained. I did take the Emmys back at the end.
I was going to ask you.
So on the other hand, you know, my first one, I just let my parents have, you know, it's just like, there's wonderful moments like Letterman hosted an Emmys that I got to write a lot of. And I remember we won Emmys that night as well. So it was kind of a double whammy. And I remember leaving the Shriners Auditorium or whatever it was, walking down this little hall, this little alleyway, and Robert Stack, do you know this actor from the, you know, the Untouchables and various, he was a tough guy actor.
Yes.
Anyway, there's no one else around. He's walking past us and he looks at us holding our Emmys and he just goes, nice going. And I went, oh my God, that's the guy I watched when I was a kid on TV. And he's telling me nice going for the, why that would be greater than going up on stage and talking through a fog. I will say on the first Emmys, there was some clip that they showed on Entertainment Tonight for several days afterwards that somehow amused them. I thanked NBC for all the free coffee. And when we got back to New York, the unit manager, who's like the financial officer of the show, said, you know, NBC doesn't pay for the coffee. The production company pays it. There's always somebody who's going to correct you for your not exactly accurate joke, such as the blues.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
It has meant more to hear kind words from fellow writers. A great moment for me, though I'm sure Steve Martin will not remember it. We worked together for 6 months on a show called The Downer Channel that had many, many, many problems. So it had wonderful cast, including Wanda Sykes. But we would have what they call blind reads. At the beginning of the week, the cast would read through new pieces, but there would never be a writer's name at the top of this. So no one knew who had written what.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of each blind read, I'd go back to my little cubicle. But Steve Martin would always stick his head in and slap his hand on the back of some taped piece of the script and say, gotta be Steve O'Donnell, you know, a relationship roadshow. That has got to be Steve O'Donnell. And that felt way better than any statuette. Let me say farewell to my guy here from the building. Oh, this is all right, because I think we fixed this ourselves. It's, oh, you got a little feel for New York City, right? Leaking ceilings and electrical cables falling down to kill us. But anyway, compliments like that, there's no gold plated statuette that would replace that. And the work also. If you're not taking joy in doing the work, I don't get it. There was some writer I met who plainly said he was in it till he had enough money to buy a red Testarossa.
Really?
And I said, well, I suppose some people would think that was a cool ambition. I just said, first of all, that's a shallow ambition. And second of all, you're not going to make it. And I think I was right on both counts. But I mean, you got to like doing it to start with. That's just a given. And my twin brother and I and our playmates even liked clowning around, you know? We had enough breaks and lucky overlaps of fortune and opportunity to make it into a professional life. And I wish that for everyone else who cares to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, there certainly are more shows they can work on now, but I know that it's diminished in certain ways too. It's been a strange year because of the writer's strike and so on.
Yes.
I'm glad that there have been certain gains. I really did worry about young TV writers now. We're talking from a historical perspective. It used to be a much greater experience and a much more practical, remunerative experience to work on a late night show. You could sort of depend on a salary for at least a couple of months. There wasn't, in recent years, management and producer just started using writers for a couple of weeks at a time and throwing them away. And they fixed some of that. There's a minimum agreement, how many writers you got to have and so on. They discourage the use of AI and that kind of thing. I may be a poor spokesman for what the Writers Guild achieved in that strike, but I was out there picketing almost every day, even though my skin is very fair and I really shouldn't be outside at all. But I'm happy that there's a bit more hope for young TV writers than there is now. There is currently, by the way, since you're so transfixed by Emmys, there's a little protest going on now with the Writers Guild because the Emmy organization wants to remove writing for a late night comedy variety show from the Emmys telecast.
Wow.
You know, they'll lump it in with sound editing or promotional achievements in of 30 seconds or less. I don't know how I feel about that. I kind of get it in a way that it takes a long time to read all the names and you're not sure who all is interested and who are the writers on Colbert's show and Seth Meyers' show and Samantha Bee's show or whatever are the shows nominated. I get that a little bit. They did try to fix that in some of the telecasts by having the shows provide lists of their own writers, but do it in an amusing way. You know, have Muscle Men impersonate each writer as their name is read. We did one for the Letterman show where we had all the writers sit at a table in an alley behind the Ed Sullivan Theater and read off their names and then turned a high power fire hose on them, which was at least an interesting way to end it because they really did get blown away. But because I had been a pretty busy writer, I could not be there that day for the taping. I was on remote location. So I had my identical twin brother take my place for that shot, which was an option I had that the other writers didn't have. But what is kind of strange, and I've never shared this anecdote before, when I was just showing the clip today, this is what they'll show on the Emmys when they read the names of all the writers. And he saw it and he said, oh, yeah, that's funny. But why do you look so weird? And I went, oh, Dave, good eye. That's Mark. He knew who Mark was. He was friends with my twin brother, too. We did appear together sometimes on the show when we needed like a cloning booth joke or a long lost brother kind of joke. So, well, that was funny. But he was close enough to kind of go, it's you, but it's not you.
That's not you. Oh, that's funny. That's great, Steve. Thank you. I just have a couple questions left, sir. Okay. I appreciate it. Well, I absolutely am not going to have you on and not ask you about Norm MacDonald, one of my all-time favorite comedians. As I know you know, I interviewed a while back Hugh Fink, who wrote jokes for him and so on. You worked with him on Norm MacDonald Live, and Norm MacDonald has a show. I got to ask, what was it like working with that man?
Well, highly unpredictable. He didn't like preparing too many things far in advance. Most of the podcast stuff I showed him an hour before we started taping. And again, he didn't take really long things. There's a couple of long written things that I did for him, a fake graduation commencement speech. He wasn't great. I mean, he did sketches on Saturday Night Live, but he always sort of complained about those. But he did lots of like blue card jokes and tweet type jokes that I wrote. And that was a pleasure. I found him to be utterly original, someone who had to do what he did, the way somebody who's just a great saxophone player has to play that saxophone. But mysterious, even people who knew him for years, there were things you couldn't quite figure out. He would, you know, he'd be in the middle of an interview with Jane Fonda, and then he would break into a William S. Buckley voice. And you're going, why is he doing that? He's scaring Jane Fonda. But even he couldn't really explain it afterwards. He was mercurial. He was impish. He was mischievous. Occasionally, he could be a little scary. There was like a lightly tough guy aspect about him. He grew up sort of in rural Canada. He was admiring and entertained, as I was as a kid, by all the World War II veterans and World War I veterans around me, which isn't always the inspiration for comics, you know. But he really liked listening to them talk. And he also saw the sort of comical aspect of their character and so on. I only say that he had a lot of influences that are not ordinary. He had a lot of contradictions. He did not drive a car, even though he became a spokesperson for a Canadian auto insurance company, something I can share now that he's deceased. He delected old stuff as well as new. Again, he could go on. He loved Rodney Dangerfield. He loved Bob Hope. There were things that he really got a kick out of. He would get a kick out of the way Burt Lancaster would be able to say a whole sentence in one syllable, like, you're a little cupcake made of arsenic. You're a little cupcake made of arsenic. I did a bad job of it. But if you heard Norm say it, you would laugh for a week. He really was way smarter than anybody would get. We hear about him reading the Russians, the Dostoevsky and so on. And I wonder if some of that was because he knew about some impending doom. But he was very smart about a million things. He appeared casual. He wore the same couple of sweatsuits over and over again. But when it came to preparing an act, he couldn't have been more careful and masterful about it. He knew what he wanted to get done and got it done, and yet at the same time allowed for spontaneous inspiration when it came about. Even on tape, you see in his eyes, there's some kind of little flash fire there. He is something else again. Every girl I knew, they all thought, he really likes me. They come in and say hello to him in his office and then go like, he was so nice. And he would remember their name, you know, 6 months later. And it was like, anyway, there was something charming, charming about him. There was also a kind of self-destruction there too. I mean, he lost all his money from sports gambling 3 different times.
Yeah.
I'd say, what do you do? He said, well, first of all, you want to lose all of it. You don't want to have $1,000 left in some checking account. You want to lose all of it. So you really are. There's something minty, fresh, invigorating about losing all your money. But yes, he would have that kind of self-destruction. But he didn't like executives. He had a lady friend manager who still, you know, does her best to keep his memory and post-mortem career going, Lori Jo Huckstra. She was like the person who could deal with executives for him. But he had some real natural aversion. At Comedy Central, I worked with him on another show that was on Comedy Central called Sports Show, which in a way was the purest norm. It was just him doing, it was like Weekend Update, but for a half hour, which made it sound not as good as I think it was. But he would get mad at the Comedy Central executives and you'd go, oh, is that all serious? Maybe I'm telling too much, but I would say that I share his anger because he was always right. They were always jerks on fairly simple things. You know, they'd be like, there's good Joshes and there's bad Joshes. Isn't there a Josh 2.0? What was the show that, you know what I'm talking about, that came on Comedy Central?
Oh, Josh 2.0?
Oh, Tosh. Well, you got to forgive me. Tosh is not exactly. But for some reason, Tosh was not a Norm Macdonald fan, at least at that time. And he'd make these put-down comments about Norm having a show that would lead into his show and how it wasn't going to be helpful and blah, 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 and how it's probably doomed. And that made Norm mad because he wouldn't have done the reverse even if he thought it. Anyway, I'm just saying he was an unusual character, a big boy in certain ways, and yet there was, between the Dostoevsky and the great, decent friendship, he was a noble character and just a very, very interesting, unpredictable brain.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I feel like I want to at least make the comment, you know, you mentioned his distaste for executives. that must have something to do with Don Ohlmeyer, I imagine, whole OJ thing.
I was not around for any of that, but I am acquainted with the great Jim Downey, and he has given me some perspective on that. Yeah, I think there was a dislike for executives, and in this case, there was a particular, I'm going to use the word cynosure, that means the thing that he's getting focused on, with the OJ jokes. So it brought his natural, you know, aversion into outright antipathy.
Right.
How am I doing with my...
Quite good. It's like you're a writer or something.
Yes. But again, whose side are you going to be on in that? I can't imagine somebody going, well, you know, when you think about Don Ohlmeyer's perspective, he does have a few... Like, no.
Well, and then...
Norman, Jim Dunn, completely right.
Completely. And then they, of course, brought Norm back to host SNL, as I'm sure you know. Gave it another infamous monologue.
Because the show now sucked.
Now sucked.
They could have on bad, unfunny hosts.
Excellent. Well, I suppose I'd love to ask you, Steve, of all your jobs, which has been your favorite, do you think?
Oh, you know, it seems obvious, but it's like that first love.
Mm.
I was in my 20s. I went from being a horrible clerk in a videotape library at NBC to making, to me, the princely sum of $1,000 a week. But it wasn't that. It was getting the job on Letterman, having Meryl Marco and Dave Letterman hire me. And also each day, just whatever was in my head, I could put down. And then you'd see it. They'd build it. They'd make the cream corn volcano, by golly. And it was a spectacular pleasure. And as with so many of the great pleasures in a well-led life, it had to do with the people that were around you, too. You just said, I can't believe I'm getting to be pals with Andy Breckman and with Sandy Gillis and Tom Gamble, and aren't these people great? And there were interesting things about some of the leader jobs. Again, the distinctive character of everyone involved with Seinfeld. On the Kimmel show, the writers were a much more wide-ranging groups. They weren't a bunch of guys in button-down shirts. There was a former male stripper. There were a lot of borderline actual lunatics that not only couldn't have gotten jobs on other TV shows, couldn't have gotten jobs in any working situation anywhere. But Kimmel liked collecting oddball people, and somehow that worked for him. And somehow the material. So that was an interesting job, too. And Kimmel, of course, such a warm character, you know, half Italian, but really very Italian, and which was a great contrast to Letterman. I like both styles, but I had to get used kind of like the adopted sheltered dog to getting touched and patted and knuckle knocked. I learned how to knuckle knock from Jimmy Kimmel like around 1997 or so. I don't think people do that anymore. Or maybe they did during the pandemic. I don't know.
That's wonderful, Steve. I love it. Well, Steve O'Donnell, that was all I had for you, my friend.
Yes, I'm sorry I confused you with Tosh. You're a much finer person than Tosh.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. I accept that kindly. Thank you.
Yes, and I'm sure he has his points. Okay. All right. Well, nice talking with you. Good luck with everything.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate it. Yeah, it was great speaking with you, and I wish you all the best.
Okay. And if I get electrocuted from the cable in my yard, that footage will be very interesting to show at the inquest.
I'll wait for the subpoena, right?
All right. Thanks for meeting you.
You too, sir.
Care. Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. We can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.